So welcome, everyone. Thank you for coming tonight. It's an interesting night for actually this is our last night here in Yogani, and actually our last night in the wanderings of our community from space to space, because in 2 weeks we will be in our own home, and I think most of you know that we will begin meeting Sunday mornings. From 10 to noon, for various reasons. Many people felt that was a better time, even though I know many people have kind of gotten used to this time and rearranged their schedules to be available Sunday. Generally, it's been a feeling that it's a difficult time for certain people because of work the next day, families, other kinds of things. End of the weekend, and this way we can meet Sunday mornings and still have a full day ahead of us. So we'll begin there in 2 weeks on November 4th at 10 o'clock. And also for our first day after that, we'll be having a brunch. And so if people are coming on Sunday and are going to stay for the brunch, please go to the website and sign up so we know how many people are coming. So before we return to this wonderful teachings we began 2 weeks ago on the eight verses for training the mind, or retraining the mind, really, are there any questions that anybody has about practice, practice of mindfulness, meditation, and the practices of transforming our lives with the teachings and practices? Please, if you have any questions of any sort, please feel free to ask them. Don't be shy. Moment. But luckily it's past and we can all relax. Right, he'll get on with the teaching. Good. So, you know, I'm looking at eight different translations, three different translations of the eight verses of Geshe Langri Tangpa 1054 to 1123 Tibet. But these practices, as I said earlier, were transmitted to Tibet from India, the home of Buddhism. And these eight verses in various forms have been very much part of the tradition of what's called the Bodhisattva tradition, or the tradition that really not only seeks an enlightenment based on wisdom, understanding of the mind, but bases an enlightenment on a deep, profound, selfless caring and compassion for all beings. And so we went through the first two verses last time with the thought of attaining enlightenment for the welfare of beings who are more precious than wish-fulfilling jewels, I will constantly practice holding them dear. Again, for those of you who weren't here 2 weeks ago, the talks are posted or will be posted soon or on the website. That's they're posted or will be posted. Will be posted soon. So again, the thought of attaining enlightenment for the welfare of beings, again, very simply, is the crystal clear formulation of this mind, of this enlightened being, this warrior being, this spiritual warrior who he or she wants to awake, wants to transform themselves so they can help people, not just for themselves, so they can be better citizens, better parents, better sons and daughters, better friends, better members of their community. Be a really help. And we know that the more we can rid ourselves of our own suffering, the more we can rid ourselves of our own narcissistic self-centeredness, the more our own spontaneous and natural wisdom and understanding, intelligence, good heart, etc., are free to function, the better able we will be to help, be of help to people, really of help to people. And he says, you know, they're very precious, these beings, because every aspect of my development that I wish to undertake, it can only be done in relationship to others. I cannot develop patience on my own. I need irritable people. I cannot develop patience without having situations that frustrate me. Right? And when we think about that, we go, oh yeah, that's right. You know, I want to be a loving person. Well, you know, you want to do that in relationship to people. Right? I want to be a selfless person. I want to be a caring person. All those things. So everything is in relation to others. That is why I hold them, I see them as wish-granting jewels. It is they who give me, you know, this capacity to develop myself. I cannot do it by myself. And again, it's as I said last time, I will constantly practice holding them dear. For those of you who go, wow, I'm not even close, please understand that he says, I will practice. You know, it's only by practicing. It doesn't come naturally. Right? Egocentricity. Self-centeredness comes naturally. We don't have to work at that. At least I would speak from personal experience. Thinking only of myself is what seems natural and normal. Realizing, developing a completely altruistic way to live life is something that has to be practiced. And then we spend a little more time with this whole thing about seeing myself as lowest, and seeing others as supreme. And again, as I said, those who weren't here last time, this kind of seeing myself as low or lowest and everybody supreme, this is not some sort of, this is not some sort of psychological victimization or psychological, self-abnegation or thinking low of oneself, and it's none of that. It is really simply that that we know that when we really love someone, when we really care for them, we naturally and spontaneously say what? Oh, you first. You first. No, you first. You go through the door first. You first. Right? Let me serve you first. No, you take the best. Yeah, I don't need. So we know that when we love somebody and we want them to be happy, right? We naturally and spontaneously are quite happy to put them first. Please understand, this is a healthy putting first. This is not a sacrifice, or this is not because I am less than or worse than in any psychological sense or value sense. Is that clear? This is none of that. The bodhisattva, the spiritual practitioner, is a healthy human being. Her actions come from a healthy mind, not an unhealthy mind. Right? So this is also not a mind of again, false humility, you know. Oh, you know, you see that in some traditions, you know, this kind of, oh, we're supposed to be humble, so let me act humble, right? But inside I'm kind of, patting myself on the back for being so humble. I am the humblest of them all. Haven't I developed this wonderful humility? I'm hoping everybody is noticing how humble... how humble I am. I am a true worthy vehicle. Like that. That is not what this is about. If that is what's about, it is a posture. It is false. It is hypocrisy. It is coming from a place of ego. But what kind, right? a big, fat, humble ego, you see. That's what this is. And this is not what we are about. So again, those will be posted, and we can go on to the next verse. And again, I'm looking at these various translations of the third one, where it's in one verse it says, "May I examine my mind in all actions, and as soon as a negative state occurs, since it endangers myself and others, may I firmly face it and avert it." So you can see each of these paragraphs are very powerful. Here it says, "In all actions, I will learn to search into my mind, and as soon as an afflictive emotion arises, endangering myself and others, will firmly face and avert it." And "In all actions, I will examine my mind, and the moment a delusion arises, endangering myself and others, I will firmly confront and avert it." So you can see, I mean, you know, everybody's translating it a little slightly differently. It's funny, everybody used the word endanger. I thought that was interesting. We don't think that way, do we? Right? I mean, it's really kind of very strange for us to think that somehow a negative thought, a negative mind state, endangers. It is dangerous. Not only to myself, but to others. So how are we endangered? What is endangered? Well, obviously, on one level, what is endangered, for those of us practicing, is our intention. You know, we are intending to lead an altruistic life. We are intending to lead a life where we, you know, very concretely manifest this goodwill to others, and we want to spread that goodwill. And obviously, a negative mind state endangers that, doesn't it? It endangers my intention. And if I am committed to my intention, I can see that indulging my mind with its proclivities toward negativity is undermining my goal. But it also, we could say, it is endangering my well-being, it's endangering my happiness. I mean, in the same way, we might understand if I want my physical body to be healthy, then taking in a negative toxic substance endangers my health. Right? We kind of know that, right? It endangers my sense of well-being. I mean, many people eat sort of junk foods or eat foods that really aren't good for one. And then one finds not too long afterwards, one does not feel good, right? One maybe has a stomach ache, or one feels heavy, or one feels a little sick to one's stomach, you know? So eating that food which is negative for oneself is endangering our health and well-being. Well, we need to think about our mind even more so, but we don't. We're willing to be much more sensitive to endangering the health and well-being of our bodies, and yet we tolerate as normal all these various mind states of anger and resentment and fear and hurt and, you know, et cetera, all these and jealousy and all these negative mind states which are endangering the well-being and the happiness and the peace of our mind, again, as normal. So you can see this is very different. This is very unusual because we do not come in a culture that understands clearly the centrality of our mind and our mind states, thoughts, feelings, perceptions of our mind. We are much more focused on the body and sort of, you know, how people act. You know, as long as kind of you keep it together, and no matter how vile is your thought, at least you're kind of keeping a lid on things. You know, that's very acceptable. And actually, you know, we consider that, well, that's pretty good, you know. You know, and we think we're pretty good. No matter, you know, what I really would really like to say to this person, I'm not going to say it. I mean, I may say it to everybody else, you know, in gossip and all that, but I don't say it to them. So we spread our poison around sideways rather than front. But we don't realize that in the same way that when we eat a food that is toxic or junk or whatever, it's in the digestive process that the harm to the body is being done short run and long run. In the same way, our thoughts, our feelings, our perceptions, our internal dialogue, our emotional states, our food, that is, our mind is eating. And our mind digests it. And our mind turns it into something. And that even if we have been keeping a lid on it in the situation, we are planting seeds within our minds that will fester. And they will come out again and again and again. Because the seeds of all our thoughts, all our feelings, all our perceptions, all our memories, all our experiences are in the mind. And in Buddhism, we have a special part of the mind called the storehouse consciousness, the alaya vijnana, for those of you who read these things, the storehouse consciousness, in which all the seeds of experience are kept. That is why you may wonder, why is it when you sit in meditation doing nothing, things keep popping up? Thoughts, feelings, perceptions, memories, feelings, right? You can be doing nothing. What, they pop up because there is, in our storehouse consciousness, they are constantly coming up into consciousness and going back down. You know, if you wonder, you know, dreams. Again, dreams are also sort of coming up from this storehouse consciousness in their own way. So to think that the mind states that I cultivate, even if I don't act on them, even if I don't speak on them, are benign, will not affect me, that is not true. If you want to know why you're feeling a certain way today, why you're thinking a certain way, why you have a certain emotion, it is because these mind thoughts have occurred in the past. As well as they endanger, obviously, how we our relationships. Because oftentimes we don't keep a lid on things. And oftentimes our thoughts and our feelings and our mind states act in the world. They act in the world through the vehicle of our mouth and through the vehicle of our body. And so oftentimes, if we're honest, we see that the actions of our speech and our mind do harm. They endanger the well-being of relations, the harmony of relationships, the happiness of relationships. We know that a strong, angry word, a strong, hurtful word, can undo undo years of goodness. So we have to be careful. So he says, may I examine my mind? In all my actions, I will search my mind. The moment a delusion arises, I will examine my mind. So now we are talking in this very concrete teaching about the practice of mindfulness. And here we're talking, you know, in the practice of mindfulness, going back to the Buddha, in the Anapanasati Sutra, we talk about mindfulness of the body, mindfulness of sensations, feelings, and mindfulness of the mind and the, you know, and the mind meaning the thoughts and perceptions of the mind. So in our practice of mindfulness, it is not simply a mindful of drinking tea, a mindful of the breath, but we, this capacity of being aware and being present to ourselves, to our body, to our breath, to our walking, to our drinking, to all the actions of our body, we also need to be mindful of our mind states. We need to examine the state of our mind. When we don't examine the state of our mind, we will what? We'll get ambushed. We will endanger. Oftentimes, we wonder. People go, you know, where'd that come from? I can't believe, you know, all of a sudden I just blew up. Right? All of a sudden I just blew up. Or all of a sudden, I can't believe I said that. You know, we talk this way. We are ambushed by our own behavior. We're ambushed by our own words, by our own feelings. You know, we go, I can't believe I said that. I can't believe I did that. Where did that come from? I mean, I thought we were getting along well, and all of a sudden, you know, I can't believe they did that to me. And where did that come from? It came from a mind that had already seated itself. And so the practice of mindfulness, this practice of examining my mind in all my actions, is very important, as you can see. And it doesn't mean, the analysis causes paralysis. It doesn't mean you have to tie yourself up in examining, like every time you take a little motion, why is my hand going forward like that? That can sort of drive you crazy. But it means a certain level of self-awareness, a certain level of self-examination, a certain important attention. Because in one of them he says, as soon as a negative state occurs, here they say an afflictive emotion. Here he says a delusion. So, it gives you some criteria. And I think this is important when you go, right, I have things to do. I can't be examining, everything. Again, remember we talked in the earlier about endangering, right? Endangering my peace of mind, endangering my well-being, endangering my intention, right, in this life. So in terms of that, each of us probably can understand that there are certain mind states. There are certain stories, there are certain emotions that when they arise in the mind, if we are not careful with them, if we do not know they are there, we are endangering ourselves. Is that clear? And each of us, it behooves us to know what they are. And everybody's different in here. All of us are unique, all of us have our own stories, all of us have our own modalities of feeling, thought, and perception, which are unique to ourselves. And each of us need to know, what are those mind states? What are those delusive mind states? What are those afflictive mind states that I need to be aware of? And again, so there is a what we're developing here is a generalized capacity for mindfulness of the mind, a generalized capacity for self-awareness, so if anger is your issue, you want to know when anger has arisen in me, when anger is present in me. If your modality is hurt, that when you perceive that someone has hurt you, that's the door that opens you up to negative mind states and affliction. You know what I'm saying? Everybody's got their own issues. Everybody know what an issue is? Everybody kind of get a sense what your issues are? So you want to know when they're present. And it's only through mindfulness, it's only through this self-examination that you will develop that capacity to then do something. So here he says, as soon as the negative state occurs, since endangers myself and others, he says here, may I firmly face it and avert it. He says firmly face it and avert it. I wonder if they've been working together. And he says, I will firmly confront it and avert it. So everybody seems to be saying the same thing. But let's just say confront, what they mean, but what I would say to confront something is to clearly acknowledge it, right? To clearly acknowledge that I am aware that this emotion, that this mind state is present within me. Just saying that is a wonderful first step. One, because you are aware now of what's going on inside you. But in the practice of developing a certain kind of mindfulness, which allows us to kind of objectively observe our experience, the fact that in somewhat of a dualistic way, I can say that I am aware that a feeling has arisen in me, there is a certain degree of what? Separation. To me, separation means some space. When I'm lost in it, there's no space and it's just going to run me. Right? You know, many of us, we don't realize that we've been lost in a negative mind state, we've been lost in an afflictive emotion, we've been lost in some of our delusive, one of our delusions, until the damage has been done. That's often when we realize, that we've got a little bent out of shape. Because we've said, we've acted out. Or else we find out that hours have gone by and we've just been in this kind of rotten mood. So rather than, discovering it, unfortunately, after it's run its course, the capacity to examine, to recognize, and to confront. Confront again means I am aware that this motion, this mind state, this feeling state is present in me. I am not averting my eyes, my inner eye, from it. I acknowledge it is here. And I am aware that it is endangering. This is why, again, I think that's a new one for many of us. But to kind of have a sense, and again, it only comes from a sense that because you want to be different. You don't want to be an angry person. You don't want to be a person who's always nurturing hurts and resentments. You're not always somebody who wants to be jealous of others and always, how come me? You don't want to be somebody who always dwells in senses of deficiency and inadequacy, anger, fears, worries, all those things. You don't want to, you have to have the both parts. You have to have a sense, I no longer want to be experiencing myself and my mind and body in this way, right? And two, when it, I want to experience myself as someone who has a mind that is harmonious, that is calm, that is peaceful, that is open. So when these mind states now arise that endanger that, it's endangering this sense of how I want to be. We have to have that as a guide, as the North Star, the evening star, something to look to. So now it has arisen, it is endangering my well-being, my harmony, how I want to be. I can clearly acknowledge it, confront it, and then it says, firmly face it and avert it. Avert it. So everybody says avert it. Which means what? Change its course. Right? Because left to its own devices, you know where it's heading. You know where it's heading because why? Because you've played this out hundreds of times, thousands of times, tens of thousands of times. You know its course. You know where it goes. And whether you indulge this mind state for 5 minutes or 5 hours or 5 days or 5 weeks or 5 months or 5 years, at some point you know it and you know where it goes. I've often said that the practice of Dharma, the real practice of a spiritual life, is becoming a conscious human being. Right? Conscious, not asleep. So to be a conscious human being is the one who can say, I can see, I know from experience what this is and where it's going to take me. And I choose not to go there. That's the key piece. I choose not to go there. I am going to avert the course, the trajectory of this unfolding that is just historical within me. Right? Some people say, it's like, many people think their issues and their stuff is like they were born with it. Because they seem to have the senses, well, I've always been like this. But of course, that's not true. Infants are not like this. But what it means is, it is so familiar to us that we think it is us. And we never think of averting its course. You know, most people often in the psychological realm or the kind of uninitiated realm, uninitiated into a deeper, profounder sense of what it means to be a human being, they feel good if it's like, if I can just, limit the damage. Right? In a certain way, that is an advance. Right? I don't do as much damage to myself and others as I used to do. But we're talking here about what? Averting the course. Which means two things. Not doing, not indulging, not sustaining this mind state within myself. For many times may be enough. And we can talk about how to do that. But it also could mean that I am also going to do something else. So one is a kind of a stopping. One, it could be a letting go of. And there are lots of ways of going about that. But the other thing is I'm going to do something different. Right? So I'm thinking to myself, that Helena, she doesn't do a damn thing. She didn't come to the workday yesterday. She doesn't care about the Sangha. She doesn't do it. You know what I mean? You can see we get stuck in these things, right? Now, again, I could just stop that thought and just stop it, right? And distract myself or do something else or go back to my breath, becomes like a... Or else I could also turn it around and go, well, that's not true. Helena does so many things for the Sangha and has done so many things. And there's probably a good reason why she doesn't come. And I myself didn't come last week. But that was totally acceptable. Why is it not acceptable when somebody else comes? So you can see you can begin to transform the way you are thinking. Right on the spot. Turn it around. Take that narrow, judgmental mind and turned it into an open mind. Take that critical mind and turned it into a positive, accepting mind. Exactly. That's just one little example. Because oftentimes, if you examine your quote unquote negative mind state, you'll see it is a stuck mind state. It's a very narrow mind state, and it's kind of just picked out a couple of little things, and it's obsessing. And it's kind of lost the big picture, whether the big picture of myself, the big picture of someone else, the big picture of life, right? It's gotten very petty, very small. And we want to take this little petty mind of ours and open it up. Sometimes we want to take this little narrow, petty mind of ours and turn it around. You know, you can see it totally opposite. Situation, person. May I examine my mind in all actions. Again, you know, this is said sort of like a prayer or an affirmation. It's really in Buddhism, it's really about setting intentions. But you could see this is something you could recite every morning as part of your meditation. Every day. May I examine my mind today in all my actions, so that as soon as a negative state occurs, since it endangers myself and others, may I firmly face and avert it. Is there anybody here who could not see the benefit of reciting this verse? Cannot see the benefit of remembering it during the day? Is there anybody here who cannot see the benefit of practicing it? There may be somebody here who does. May I examine my mind in all actions as soon as a negative state occurs, since it endangers myself and others, may I firmly face and avert it. In all my actions, I will learn to search into my mind, and as soon as an afflictive emotion arises, endangering myself and others, will firmly face and avert it. I'm not going to turn away. Yes. Actually, what's your name again?
Chris.
It's the next verse, actually. Exactly speaks to the other person, and you may be interested in what it says. But now we're talking about ourselves, because again, can we control the other person? No. I mean, we all know that. There's one thing we've all learned. I can't control another. I mean, that's like gospel these days. The only person I have a good chance of affecting change over their behavior, over their language, over their mind states is... So that is why, Chrissy, we get more bang for our buck by examining our own mind, by attending to our own negativity, to our own mind states. Because again, we go through the day with who? We think we're going through the day with others, but that's not true. We go through the day with who? Ourselves. That's our companion. And as we go through the day, depending on who we are and the way we are, we can be affected by other people, right? By their actions, by their words, by their mind states. But the truth is, we experience everything through our own minds. When we understand that, we realize that in a certain way, we do have control over the other person, but not in the way we think. In other words, we say things like, well, you know, you made me do it. Right? We talk that way, don't we? You made me do that. Or I'm feeling this way because of you. Because of what you said. Because of what you did. Or because of what you didn't do. Right? That's why I'm feeling this way. I blame you. I hold you responsible for how I'm feeling. Right? I mean, if we're honest, is there anybody here who's never talked that way or thought that way? But the truth is what? Nobody can make us feel a certain way. Nobody can. Feelings arise within our own minds. Thoughts arise within our own minds. Nobody can make us do anything. The more conscious we are, the more mindful we are, we know that all of us have that capacity. I mean, we know, let's take the realm of nonviolence. We know that advocates of nonviolence say what when someone is violent to you? Practice what? Violence? No. Practice nonviolence. When somebody hates you, return love. So we know that we have an incredible capacity to act in and think and feel in ways that are so different than what's considered normal. We have that power. So that's why, may I examine my mind. Many of us much rather examine other people's minds. I love examining everybody else's mind. I'm really just incredibly perceptive. I really understand everybody else. I mean, it's just, I'm an expert. Right? There are many experts in this room who are just very good at perceiving anybody else, figuring them out, and really knowing what's best for them. And aren't we? And that's going, yeah. And yet, at the end of the day, if we don't know ourselves, if we're not examining our own minds, and if we're not confronting our own afflictive emotions, our own negative mind state, our own behaviors that endanger the well-being of ourselves and others, it's all for naught. What time do we end? We end at 8:30. Okay. So let me just go on for Chrissy's sake. We'll go into the next verse. Now listen to this one. This is not what you're expecting. When I see beings of a negative disposition, those oppressed by negativity or pain, may I, as if finding a treasure, consider them precious, for they are rarely met. Or, I mean, talk about a 180, right? I will learn to cherish all beings of bad nature. How many of us is that our operating in life? Cherish all beings of bad nature. We don't like people of bad nature, do we? We don't like to work with them. We don't like to work under them. We don't like to have them work for us. We don't like to be in relationship with them. We don't like to be neighbors of them, right? Let's rid the world of people of bad nature. I will learn to cherish all beings of bad nature and those pressed by strong sins and sufferings as if I had found a precious treasure difficult to find. And this translation says, whenever I meet a person of bad nature who is overwhelmed by negative energy and intense suffering, I will hold such a rare one dear as if I had found a precious treasure. And here it says, When I see beings of negative disposition or those oppressed by negativity or pain, may I, as if finding a treasure, consider them precious, for they are rarely met. So again, Chrissy, your question was?
How do you deal with other people who are negative towards you?
Okay. So, I mean, I think at a certain level, there are things, you know, about that. But let's just go with this one, because this kind of gives us a, this is what's, when one is following a spiritual path in life, when one is following a certain type of intention or aspiration of how one wants to be in life, and if one is serious about that, not just paying lip service, but is serious, we now have a context in which the experiences of our daily life unfold. We know how to deal with them. See, if someone does not have a spiritual path, if one does not have a dharma, if does not have a clarity about what one is aspiring to, how to live or how to be in this life, what is guiding us in our interactions? If we don't have that, what's guiding us what? Is ourself. And ourself is what? Is our conditioning, is our way we've always done it, is the way we've been conditioned to be and to think and to feel. So we're always lost in reactivity from the way we've been conditioned. When one has a spiritual path, when one has a real clear sense of values and meaning, now one has a different context in how to interact with people. So now he's saying, okay, so when I run into someone who's negative, someone's of a bad nature, first of all, I see someone who is suffering. It's interesting. I see somebody who is suffering. Or he says here, I see someone oppressed by negativity or pain. Well, that's interesting, doesn't it? Can you think about the context? Because usually when we run into somebody of a bad nature, especially when they're sharing their bad nature with us, or sending their bad nature right at us, we see what? We see a jerk. We see other names we could call them. We see the enemy, right? We don't see, wow, this person is suffering. This is somebody in pain. Right? This is somebody totally overwhelmed by their own delusions. Because only somebody like that would act in this way. So, again, it doesn't mean we may not actually act in ways to protect ourselves, on a very practical level. But we are looking at this person very differently. You know, you may be in relationship with somebody. You may be in a loving relationship with somebody, an intimate relationship or a family relationship with somebody. And many times they may act in ways that are causing you to be upset, right? Is that the case for anybody here? Yes. And if you notice when that happens, where our mind goes, we are blaming, we are labeling, we see them as the, just evil in that moment. And we are what? We are the victim, we are all good, we are pure, we are, right? I mean, that's the context. They are bad in that moment, no matter whether we in the moment, whether in the bigger picture we think we love them, in that moment they are what? Bad, right? Evil, rotten, no good. We do not see them as a suffering being, overwhelmed by their pain. Do we? No, we don't. And you to look at the other, even if they're angry at you and said something very unkind to you or whatever, to look at them and see, this is someone who's suffering. She's suffering right now. She really feels this. She really believes this, right? And anybody who's going through that is in a very negative mind state. They are overwhelmed with their negative afflictions. They are suffering. Can you see how it changes? Can you think of situations? We all have these situations with people. Can you see, to see that person as a person who is suffering, as someone who is in pain, really is a significant shift immediately. Because it now allows us to open up to what? To compassion. To understanding. Now, most of us, when we believe someone has hurt us, disappointed us, or made us angry, has anybody noticed that that feelings of love and understanding and compassion just naturally flow forth? No. Because in that moment, we are framing this situation, I'm the one that's suffering, they're the ones who's causing me to suffer. I don't see them as suffering or as equally suffering. Even if they have taken the aggressor mode with me, right? They are suffering. They're in pain. They're out of control. They're in control of their negative forces. They're in control of their negative mind. And again, please let me say, I am not saying that we put up with abuse. I mean, you know what I'm saying? I'm not saying we don't protect ourselves. I'm not saying we don't do all kinds of things. But again, it's the mind state that's behind it. I mean, wasn't there somebody in some other religious tradition who said something to the effect, love thy enemies? Anybody ever hear that? It's kind of a well-known catchphrase. And that's what we're talking about, isn't it? So how do you love your enemies? Well, you've got to stop seeing them as your enemy. Because love your enemy really means in that moment, we're perceiving someone as an enemy in my mind. If you love somebody, Thich Nhat Hanh says, if you love somebody, it means you understand them. It means you're willing to step into their shoes and see the world the way they see it, feel what they're feeling, and understand the causes and conditions that have produced them. That's what he said love is. When you love somebody, they are not your enemy, are they? They are an object of your compassion. Now, let me come back to Chrissy. Does that answer your question, or is there more to it? Yeah. On a practical level, it's a willing to acknowledge that the way they are seeing it, or the hurt, or the anger, or whatever it is, the misperception, whatever the deal is, that for them in that moment it is valid. They think it's real, and their hurt, their anger is also suffering. So it's sort of in that moment acknowledging what? We're both suffering. And I'm willing to acknowledge, which usually when we're in our ego, when we're ourselves, we are not willing to acknowledge, are we? In that moment, willing to acknowledge, I see that you believe that, I've caused you suffering, or I've done this to you. I understand that. And I'm sorry. Again, I'm not, and some people say, oh, you say you're sorry, then you're saying they're right. No, you're not. It's not like that at all. It just say, especially if you care for somebody, you're saying, I'm sorry that you're going through this, and that you think that I did this to you. I'm sorry about that. You see, I'm sorry about the situation. I'm sorry that it's developed this way. And in that acknowledgement, there's a chance for what? Because usually, if someone, like you say, is coming at you, and if you, what do you usually do, Chrissy, when someone's coming at you? In that way. What? Yeah. Right, right. So, and then you can see, you remember we talked earlier about, you know, we know where this is going. Right? If we could step back, we would say, oh, I know where this one's going, right? Where's it going, Chrissy? What? It's going down, right? Right. Again, that other person may not have dharma enough that they can say what we're saying, but you could. Right? You could say, I'm not going to let it go down the way it always goes down. I'm going to do something different. Is that, you know, it's very different, isn't it? It's not the way we do it. It's, you know, good dharma, good spiritual practice is a 180 from the way we usually do things. That's why it's good. We go, wow, that's totally a 180 from the way I would want, you know. See, if somebody lets me have it, you know, my job is what? Let them have it. You know, they're telling me what they think of me. I'll let them know what I think of them. And more so. Right? Which is what? Primes them for what? Giving it back. Or else what? Or else people shut down, go away. But they, how do they go away? Yeah, they feel bad. The negative mind state. And so it just festers. And that describes certain types of relationships that people have, don't they? So we want to get out of that. And there was another... again, can everybody hear what Helena is saying? She's saying, she's understanding that what we're talking about in compassion is not I got to go run in and do something. I got to fix it. I'm responsible for this. I mean, that's not compassion. In Buddhism, compassion, it's interesting, means two things. It unites two different words. You know, in English, there's the word empathy. Empathy means sort of, you know, I feel. You know, I feel what you're feeling. I'm an empathic human being. I can feel somebody else is feeling. But in Buddhism, the word karuna, which is translated as compassion, means I am in touch with the suffering, and I want to do anything I can to alleviate it. I want to alleviate the suffering. How can I help? So just to, we might say, if someone has a knife in their belly, and I come across them in my wandering, would you consider it very compassionate of me to sit down beside them, to ask them how they're feeling, and then to offer them empathic statements? Would that be considered a compassionate person? Oh, I can see having a knife in your belly must feel terrible. I see that you're bleeding. Gee, this is terrible. I'm sure you're feeling very despondent because if nothing changes, you could die. Oh, that's terrible. Here, let me put my arms around you and offer you... I mean, is that compassion? No. It looks compassionate, right? But we would say, what? You know... If somebody has a knife in their belly, Well, let's say you know what you're doing. You would do what? Pull it out. And if not, I would call 911 and get, right? You'd say, yeah, it's active. Can you see? In Buddhism, karuna is something active. I mean, obviously, if someone is dying and there's nothing to be done, then offering them consolation to offer them support, may be all we can do. So it's a situation. The classic analogy is, if the drug addict is has run out of their drugs, and they're feeling kind of a little sick. Would it be a compassionate action for you to go buy their drugs for them? There are people who think that is. But these days we call them what? Your neighbor. You see, we get it, right? And we'd say they're in a codependent relationship with that person. So we know what? We know that, again, something that would look kind. Look, this poor person is suffering, right? And if we just run down the street to their source and get them the drug they need, they'd no longer be suffering. Isn't that the compassionate thing to do? And we would say, it's an interesting, in a certain way, we'd say, well, yeah, I'm alleviating their suffering. But you go, no, if you look more deeply, right? If your wisdom has some intelligence to it, some wisdom, you know that it's their suffering is brought on by the drug addiction, and if you want to help them, you would help. The best way to help them is not to do it. Right? So, in Buddhism, the kind of representation of compassion is called Avalokiteshvara. Avalokiteshvara means she, he, who hears the cries of the suffering world. And in the iconography of Avalokiteshvara, in his or her hand, these hands of compassion, you will see an eye sculpted or painted. And that is the eye of wisdom. It's very interesting. It means that hand that reaches out compassionately is reaching out not just from the heart, it's reaching out with wisdom. It kind of understands it's the situation, and it's really understanding what's causing the suffering, so their actions is helpful. Right? So Elaine, I know you have a teenage son, and if you said, he says, Mom, everybody staying out all night at this party, can I stay out all night because all my friends are? That's what everybody's doing. And you say, no, you have to be home by midnight. And all of a sudden, he starts suffering. Right? He gets hurt. He gets angry. He gets despondent. Right? You're ruining his life. Right? As anybody who's ever raised a teenager, who's been a teenager, you know how that goes. Right? Right. Now, Helena could be very compassionate and say what? Oh, go. Oh, that's okay. You go. Because that'll make him what? That'll relieve his suffering. So outwardly, you could think, oh, I'm a good mummy. I'm relieving my son's suffering. But we know that in relieving his suffering, you may be contributing to a deeper suffering. Is that clear? So, I mean, we could go on with more examples, but coming back to the situation Chrissy was talking about, how in this situation that we may be involved with another human being, is there a way to alleviate the suffering? Which doesn't mean, to give in to him. But is there a way to act in this situation that contributes to a diminishing of suffering? And sometimes, as we know, the simple acknowledgement to the other person that they're suffering too. Simply acknowledging the other person that they have a perception of the situation which is as valid as mine. It doesn't mean it's right. It doesn't mean it's true. It's saying, I can understand that you see it that way. You know, when you turn it around, when you feel somebody you're in disagreement with, rather than treating you like you're an idiot or a fool or have totally missed the point or whatever, but says to you, "Oh, well, that's a valid point. Yeah, I can understand why you would see that way. Oh, how do you feel at that moment? How do you feel? Good. Yeah, it's like, wow, that's wonderful. You know, all of a sudden, your feeling of alienation and estrangement and anger just, ooh, the other person, yeah, they're willing, even though they disagree with me, they're willing to acknowledge me and my point of view or my feelings, and that feels good. And right away, it's like, oh, they're no longer what? The enemy. They're no longer the enemy. And we want to, get rid of this, you know, notion of enemies. I will learn to cherish all beings of a bad nature. And finally, let me just say, one of the reasons we are cherishing all beings of a bad nature, it's sort of like the same. Remember, we talked about sentient beings or the wish-granting jewel. Because if I said, do we choose, consciously choose to be around people of bad nature? No. Most of us would go, if I could engineer my life in a way that I didn't have to deal with anybody with any negativity, that would be wonderful, right? So why does he say, I will learn to cherish all beings of bad nature? Because one, they bring out in me, historically, negativity. They bring out my bad nature. So if I want to liberate myself from my bad nature, who better to help me do that than someone of bad nature? And again, if I want, you know, if my object in life is to become wiser, more intelligent, more compassionate, more patient, you know, who's going to help me do that better than somebody that pushes all those buttons? Right? So that is why in this tradition, it's they just have these, you know, I mean, most people, if you go, if you say to people, oh, I really cherish people who are total jerks. Yeah, you know what I mean? Give me a total jerk and there's nothing that makes me happier. Give me somebody who's just so full of negativity that they just, you know, you're around them, you can feel it, right? Wow, do I cherish those kinds of people. Nothing makes my day. You come home at night and say, God, I just ran into one, you know what, after the other today. What a great day. Just wonderful. And most of us come home, we go, you know, we're fit to be tied, or, you know, running into all these people they have to deal with, right? We're outraged that we have to even deal with these kinds of people. Right? Can you see the bodhisattva goes, wow, how wonderful. What a wonderful, I had a great day today. I mean, I had such opportunities to practice patience, to practice real compassion, to generate loving kindness to people that are difficult to me. It was just a wonderful day. Wow. Easy? No. So this is the practice. But in these little verses, as we will see, we are being shared a mind and a mind state that is totally different than ours. And if we are really embracing a spiritual path, we'll go, wow, incredible. Never in a million years would I have thought that all these jerks that I got to deal with at work, I can cherish. And I can be grateful to the opportunities they're giving me to really become a compassionate and loving human being. Whew. We would never think like that. So, so it's because of that we cherish people of bad nature. But again, you know, I mean, we don't let them abuse us. We, I mean, there are things we do, and they're on a very practical level. But this is about the mind. We don't have to hate people. We don't have to turn them into less human. Even people who do terrible things. And, you know, we read about people who do terrible things. And even though these people do terrible things, we may have to separate from society for a while and punish them. We do it with a sense of regret. Because we know that they are just a product of causes and conditions themselves. They didn't just come from nowhere. Causes and conditions created them. Healthy people do not do those kinds of things. Right? And so we can, when we acknowledge that they're suffering, they're in pain, it again changes our relationship to them. So even if we have to act in a way, again, to punish or separate them from society because they are out of control and their negativity leads them to do things that are harmful to others. Again, we do it from a place of understanding and compassion, not a place of hatred. You know, not a place of self-righteousness. Because again, as we said the other week, like Thich Nhat Hanh says in the poem, we are both. We are the victim and we are the perpetrator. Because if we had grown up in the family of the perpetrator, if we ourselves had grown up in that family, if we had experienced everything that perpetrators experienced in their life, we too, today, would be perpetrators. Right? And when we understand that, it takes that hatred out. It takes that self-righteousness out. It allows us to understand things. Good. I think it's pretty clear. So we'll end here. Please practice these verses during the week. And again, we'll see you again in 2 weeks, Sunday, 10 o'clock at our new center. And please come, and please come often. Please make it your new home. And we'll have a lot going on there over these coming months and years. And